Hello, everyone. I'm Liam Burke, Managing Director of B. Riley Securities, and welcome to Capital Link Shipping Sector Webinar Series. Today, we'll be discussing opportunities, outlook, and the trends in the dry bulk sector. We have some disclaimers that I'd like to read before we start our meeting. But before that, we have Mr. Aristides Pittas, Chairman and CEO of EuroDry Limited and Euroseas Limited. Mr. Mads Boye Petersen, CEO of Pangaea Logistics Solutions Limited. Mr. Hamish Norton, President of Star Bulk Carrier Corp. And finally, Mr. William Fairclough, Managing Director of Waquan Maritime Services Company Limited in the UK. Just to begin with, the webinar will feature a roundtable discussion with our panelists, followed by a Q&A session that will run approximately 45 minutes. Participants may submit questions at any time using the Q&A button on the webinar platform. Please, we'll do our best to address the Q&A during the session. Please note that these questions should focus only on the dry bulk sectors. Please also note that these webinars are for informational and educational purposes only and do not constitute investment advice or any other form of advice. Lastly, the webinar is being recorded today, Thursday, December 11th, 2025, and will be available later on an on-demand replay. With that, let's jump right into it. Within the dry bulk sector, each of your companies have different fleet management assets in terms of weighting different vessel classes. I'd like, hopefully, each of you could discuss that fleet strategy, and also if you could tie in how you balance time charter rates and the spot market. So, William, if I could start with you. I know you have other vessels. Your firm has other vessels outside of dry bulk, but if we could just focus on dry bulk, that'd be great.
Thank you, Liam. Yeah, just for the benefit of everybody listening, we're present in the dry bulk sector, tanker sector, and gas in the pipeline. But on the dry bulk side, focused on the three main sectors being Ultramax, Kamsarmax, you know, midsize, and the Capes. In terms of our allocation towards time charter and spot, then we have access to both. We have an operating platform. So the choice of our strategy between spot and the time charter will be very much linked to our, you know, view of the market and our risk management and our overall exposure. And in terms of the sort of age profile of the fleet, we tend to operate a relatively modern fleet, and we'll often look for the performance arbitrage between trading the modern ships, better performing ships, the more efficient ships, which we may discuss later, on our own trades, longer haul trades, and using the older ships and less efficiency sensitive routes, and on getting exposure, cover for our exposure through time charter. So that's broadly, you know, our strategy.
Great, thank you. Aristides?
Yes, well, thank you, Capital Link, for organizing this, and all the other participants for being here together with us. We are very similar, maybe smaller as a company than Waquan. We also have Supramaxes, Ultramaxes, Panamaxes, and Kamsarmaxes. So we're focusing on the mid-range, mid-size range. We think the small ones are a bit too small, the Handys for us, and the Capes, so much dependent on one cargo, we have avoided them. Wrongly so, because they have performed better than everything else, but still, our strategy is to be on dealing with ships that are more versatile and can be used with more types of cargoes and sail into different countries and not depend on, you know, one country, one commodity. But having said that, our strategy is also very similar with Waquan as it concerns chartering. We charter spot voyages up to time charters. Depending on our market view, we use FFA sometimes to get cover on our vessels. But depending on our risk profile at any given moment in time, but also on our expectations of the near-term moves of the market.
Thank you, Aristides. Hamish, Just jump in.
Sure. We basically have a fleet that is, about a little less than a third Capes, about a third Kamsarmax and Post-Panamax, and about a little over a third Supramax and Ultramax, primarily Ultramax. We did a merger with Eagle Bulk Shipping a couple of years ago, and that increased our weighting of Supramax and Ultramax quite a bit. We've been selling down the older and smaller ships, and we're getting back to about equal numbers in each of the Supramax, Ultramax, Kamsarmax, and Capesize and Newcastlemax classes. So, and that's where we'd like to be. And we're primarily spot. For two reasons. One, we think that our shareholders, when they invest in us, want exposure to the spot dry bulk market. And the other thing is we think that if you have the balance sheet to stay to take it, that you end up making more money in the spot market than if you fix out. But obviously you have to have the balance sheet to handle that.
Great, thank you. Probably Mads, could you weigh on this?
Sure. Thank you, and thanks for the invite to participate. Pangaea Logistics, we are an owner and operator of ships in the sub Cape segment, from Handysize up to Post Panamax. We are in those segments because we feel that it's the best strategic fit for our customer centric contract based platform. We feel that there's, like Aristides said, that there's a little bit more versatility in that segment. There's more opportunity. We're not dependent on a select number of commodities and trade routes. So, but within, whether it's Handysize of Supra or Post Panamax or Kamsarmax, we are pretty pragmatic. It all depends on what the customer needs are at a certain time. And in terms of our employment strategy, we use primarily voyage charter contracts. Rather than fixing our ships out on time charter to other shipping companies, our ships trade in a mix of the spot market and in our long-term COAs, typically with a focus on niche business like ice class and specialized commodities or geographical regions.
Great, thank you, Mads. Consolidation seems to be a prevalent theme in today's sector, most notably the cash offer by Diana Shipping for Genco. Is this a move towards greater consolidation in the sector, or is this a need to accelerate fleet growth, or is this just optimism that we've got an upcycle here and we want to maximize our return? So I'd like to start with Hamish, who has a little experience once or twice in this space, and if you could give us some help on this.
Well, I think there are going to be big benefits to consolidation. At the moment, it's quite difficult to actually consolidate companies because the public dry bulk companies are basically almost all trading below the net liquidation value of their hard assets. And so it's not very appealing to issue shares, in exchange for assets. At the same time, it's pretty hard to take over a shipping company at less than net asset value plus some premium because, the board is going to demand basically at least liquidation value of the hard assets. So, I think the consolidation process is stuck at the moment. And, I would be surprised if the, current, proposed deals, go through in anything like the currently proposed structure.
Thank you. Mads?
Yep, thank you. And the dynamics of the driver market as or the publicly listed markets for the driver companies, as Hamish laid out, it can't be disputed, obviously. However, there are opportunities. We did something at the end of last year where we actually merged with a private company and issued shares at our NAV at that time to add 15 handy-sized bulkers, right? It was a great fit for our company and our strategy. So it's not very liquid and it's very difficult, but there are opportunities, and at least we're in the game. And I think Pangaea for sure sees itself as a consolidator. It's probably more important from a public company standpoint than from shipping market standpoint. It's a very fragmented market, and even companies as big as Hamish, are subject to the same spot market dynamics as everybody else, right? But it is easier for us. We do see advantages with a bigger fleet to serve our customers and run the company better, especially with upcoming emissions restrictions and regulations, that scale is important.
Yes, well, firstly, for most shipping companies, consolidation does not add something dramatic if they are private companies. If you have a fleet of 15, 20 ships, you probably are exposed in the same market that Star Bulk is exposed, which has 100 ships or whatever. So there it is not a need, and that's why you don't see it happening. However, consolidation is useful and can be useful in the public markets, because in the public markets it is the only thing that can probably help the valuations eventually increase to NAV levels. I think you see that the few listed companies that are truly big, they are close to their NAV. They are not there yet, but there are periods where they are, and then they can use the currency to grow even further. So a smaller company in the public markets needs to do something. And also, most of the companies are not like Pangaea. Pangaea has a model where it is also customer-centric and has a lot of contracts of affreightment and a different operational model than most dry bulk companies, which are, we own the asset, we charter it to somebody else who uses the vessel to serve customers. So in those two cases, I think consolidation makes sense, but otherwise a company with 15 ships can be as profitable percentage-wise as a much bigger company.
Fair enough. William, you must have a different, a little different perspective on this. So I saved you for last.
Well, look, I mean, there are buyers and sellers at the moment. I think that there are definitely people taking money off the table. You can see that with some of the big deals that have been done. Plus, you've got sort of Chinese leasing companies that bought a lot of vessels in the latter part of the last decade, and they're actually taking money off the table. Whereas there are other people who are looking at the older fleet age profile and dry, and they're looking at the fleet profile compared to the order book, and generally it's looking pretty positive, and there's a positive story to tell. So you've got buyers as well. So I think that leads to activity, some of the activity we've talked about. I think the perennial problem of the undervalued public companies, Hamish has touched upon eloquently, and I don't need to expand there. But I think generally there are certainly pockets of investors who are wanting to increase their exposure to dry dramatically, having maybe been quiet or done not much for the last, in some cases, a decade or more. Whereas there are others who, were active and are now looking to take money off the table. So it leads to a relatively high degree of, sort of liquidity in the sort of secondhand market.
Great, thank you. Just as a follow-on, if I took a look at the pro forma Genco Diana balance sheet, depending on how you measure the EBITDA numbers, debt to EBITDA could be as high as 8 times. We've been looking at a trend in the sector where it has been a move towards delevering rather than levering up, understanding if you add assets, the only prudent way to finance it is with some debt. But again, the general thought process was stronger balance sheets rather than more leverage. Aristides, jumping over to you, what is your sense of how the market is looking at more or less debt?
Yes, well, I can tell you our belief about debt, which has not changed over the last 20 years. We believe that shipping is a business that, on average, you get more than 6-7% return. That is from the operations and from timing your purchases and your sales. So in that context, it would make sense if you can get cheaper debt than that to get as much debt as you can. However, too much debt becomes very risky, and we saw what happened in the previous crisis, where most of the companies, of the listed companies, had essentially to recapitalize themselves. We have always been believers of medium debt, enough debt so that you can feel safe in a downturn. So we would never go up to 70-80% debt, and we don't in any acquisition that we do, but enough debt so that you get the overall over time above a better return that shipping can provide. So our norm ourselves is around 50% debt. Maybe we go up to 60% debt in poor markets, because there the upside is significant, and 40% debt when prices are inflated. But we try and keep ourselves there, and this policy has worked. I think we are one of the two or three companies that didn't need to recapitalize themselves and reinvent themselves during the crisis of the, after 2009 and 2010.
Great, thank you. William?
I mean, Aristides thinks like a shipowner because he's a shipowner, and that's a very common theme we have. And I would echo that that's a very comfortable level that we would aim for. It's around, around 50% on a, overall net group basis, and our balance sheet. And, you will balance that by having older vessels that have, been in the fleet for a long time, which are going to be in some cases almost debt free. But in some of the newer vessels coming in, especially if you've got long-term contracts attached, then just because of the availability of very, very competitive debt at the moment, and particularly from Chinese leasing companies who, for a variety of reasons which we may or may not have time to discuss, are extremely aggressive. And so you're getting, generationally, well-priced debt at high, high leverage. But if you've got a long-term contract to service that, then it, it makes a lot of sense. But on a group basis, then, Aristides is, he's hit the nail on the head.
Great. Mads?
I mean, it's hard to disagree with anything Aristides or William said just now. Obviously, it is it's another part of our business where we adopt a a pretty sort of cautious and conservative approach as well. Right now, our debt to sort of fair market value of our fleet is around 40-45%. We are very comfortable there, and with little bit maybe more visibility into longer term cash flows, we also wouldn't mind getting that up higher if needed. However, where we are trading today with assets where asset values where they are, this is a real an area where we need to, I think, be really, really, really cautious and make sense of whatever acquisitions you do. You need to be mindful of that. But as Aristides says, I think financing and debt is available to quality companies like the ones on this call, and it's competitively priced. I think it's an absolute necessity in order to build long term the returns that you should get from this business. And I think the banks are very interested, and they're very active at the moment in trying to grow their books. So it's more a question of you not always taking what's available to you, but rather being quite cautious.
Great, thank you. And if we can round this question out with Hamish on your thoughts.
Sure. Yeah, I would second what Mad said about the debt being at attractive terms. I think we're able to borrow now at SOFR plus 140 basis points or less, which is pretty hard to turn down. But we are not levering up at this point. Our debt is at the moment, net debt is below scrap value. We basically want to be in a position where when ships are look cheap, which they don't at the moment, we're able to use our debt capacity to renew the fleet. At the moment, we're taking advantage of the high prices to sell older and smaller ships and generate cash, which we're mostly using to buy back stock rather than pay down debt. But our debt pay down is about 200 million a year just out of amortization.
Great. Thank you, Hamish. Looking at the sector, first half of 2025 was challenging. Rates came roaring back in the second half of the year. I'm looking at Capesize. We saw a nice growth in the bauxite trade, longer ton miles on iron ore. Looking at the non-Capesize, we saw a step up in coal transport, but going into 2026, do you see that momentum continuing, or do you see anything changing for the better or the worse as we move into 2026? And if we can start off with Mads, that'd be great.
No, it's been an interesting year to say the least, right? I mean, the first 6 months
Of course.
was extremely challenging, and I think was maybe it was a little bit exaggerated compared to what sort of the fundamentals suggested. But shipping is a place, we stand at the intersection of global trade wars and macro economic, and we are just very sensitive to the narrative in that, and that was very negative in that part of the year. So I think the post summer and even today, the markets are healthy, strong even, and it's so difficult to predict, right? But I think where we the way we approach it is that fleet growth still remain relatively low in historical terms. There will be more ships coming next year, but we also feel that when we talk to our customers, and our customers are power plants, steel mills, traders who are actually closer to what happens in the markets, they feel pretty confident about where they are and their demand for the next 12 months. So cautiously optimistic. That's sort of our default position, it seems. But I'm not, we're not expecting, any huge movement either direction, honestly.
Fair enough. Studies.
Yes, I would echo Mads. I it's so hard to predict the future because lately it's more about geopolitics than by than depending on the usual supply and demand calculation. If you look at Clarkson's prediction for 2026, a growth in the dry bulk fleet of 3.5%, a global trade growth of 1%, that's a negative. That shows a slight correction. But it's so difficult to form an opinion. And I would totally agree with Mats. We might see, which is a brave bet to make, that we will see a market which will be probably a little bit higher or a little bit lower than where it is. Because usually much more extreme things happen. But at least right now, the thought is that we will be probably around these levels, plus or minus 20, 25%.
Great. Hamish?
Yeah, I mean, we are pretty optimistic, actually. We think that coal, grain, and minor bulk volumes are going to continue pretty strongly into 2026. And probably support the smaller size ships quite significantly. And then, iron ore is looking pretty good. Even if Chinese steel volumes drop somewhat, the Brazilians and the and the Simandou mine in Guinea are increasing production, and we think the Chinese will take all of that production. And if they have to offset something, it would be Australian production, which is only at one third of the distance. And so we think iron ore is going to show increasing ton miles, even if tons don't increase very much, if at all. So we're basically optimistic going into 2026.
Great, thank you, William. Can we round out, have you round out this discussion?
Yeah, sure. I think I'd just focus a little bit on the importance of coal. I mean, we've seen Capesize market's still pretty firm. Panamax, Kamsarmax, whatever, and Ultramax have been weaker in the last few weeks. We've seen it start to come off, and I think part of the reason, is coal demand into China. You've seen the domestic coal price has dropped quite significantly. And just looking into that as to what triggered the market in July to really start picking up, you saw that the Chinese government limited domestic coal production, ostensibly using kind of safety inspections as a kind of tool in which to limit production. But I think, unofficially, there is a coal price that's quite carefully managed in China, because if it's too low, then, not enough money is made. And if it's too high, then that creates other problems economically, and we've seen that, that's quite an important factor for the market. And this is one of the mechanisms, and I think coal is an essential part of the market. And actually, the Chinese government policy around coal is very difficult to predict. But a weaker coal market will definitely have a more negative impact on the market next year. There's a weather factor, which is obviously impossible to predict. We shouldn't even bother. But when we see in the summer that you've got a not much rain and it's very hot, it's very positive for coal. I think the problem at the moment in China is it's not hot enough. It's been a warm summer, a warm winter so far, and so coal production is actually quite low. And because the stockpiles were pretty high, we've seen that the domestic price has dropped a lot. And so that, these are some of the factors that we watch quite carefully. I think the grain's important, but it's probably not enough to drive the market. But you saw a lot of front loading before all of the tariffs came in, and so stockpiles generally are quite high across the board, coal and grain, and even on the sort of steels front. So yeah, those are the factors we'll be looking for. But I think we're within a range, and it's not going to be catastrophic, and we will see some definitely some positive months, I think, in 2026.
Great. Thank you, William. We've seen a pretty muted order book for the last several years. Now that's beginning to change. We're seeing announcement of new build orders pretty much across the board. Bouncing that against an aging fleet, is there concern out there about excess capacity creeping into the sector? I'll start with Aristides on this.
Yes, Liam. The order book in the sectors that we are in, Kamsarmax and Ultramax, today is about 14%, I think, on Kamsarmax and 11.5% on Ultramax. This is a reasonable order book to have. It's a very reasonable order book. I mean, when we ran into trouble, we had order books up to 100% in 2005. So that which happened then, when all those vessels hit the market, led to the very bad decade we faced between 2010 and 2020. Now we don't see, have that kind of order books. They are very limited, very contained. So I'm quite certain that we will not have, well, as certain as one can be in shipping, that we will not have, such bad years as we had between 2015 and 2017. There'll be a correction one way or the other. At some point, the market, the global economy may not be faring well. Some extra thing might happen outside the normal supply demand balance that changes things. But we have an old fleet that will, in this first crisis, go for scrap. All the ships that were ordered in those new Chinese yards between 2005 and 2007, which were delivered around 2010, are becoming quite old. I'm quite optimistic about the longer term market, because the order book has been quite good after after that period. From the
Great, thank
2016 onwards, it's been a very low order book.
Great, thank you. Mads?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Aristides on that point, is that sort of looking at it in historical perspective and not just over the last couple of years, the order book is manageable. It should be manageable, right? The big question is scrapping, right? And it's really not happening right now. And I guess with markets where they are at the moment, that you won't see any. So the question is, what will the dynamics be when those ships start to deliver at over the next years, especially, right? It will be bumpy at times. It always is. But I would for sure agree that we're not in a situation where we can consider the sector to be overbuilt. And there is, if you look at just the data on the fleet and the age of the average age of the fleet is high. Some of those ships that Aristides mentioned, they probably will. I mean, they're close to the end of their life, right? The one issue is that, you know, the speed is also very low at the moment. So the world fleet is trading at a low speed, which makes the impact of a newer, more modern ship a little less than it would be back in the same times when we were going 14, 13, 14 knots, right? So that's a potentially a an unknown there. Will those ships trade longer than we expect? We simply don't know.
Fair enough. Hamish?
Yeah, I mean, basically, we see the new build market as being very expensive. You know, the shipyards seem to be relatively full with orders for container ships and tankers, and the prices of dry bulk ships seem hard to justify, you know, based upon the expected charter rates. And, you know, frankly, what we expect is that at some point the market will, you know, get weak. The shipyards will be more desperate for dry bulk orders, and you know, there will be scrapping as a result of the weak market. And what we would like to be is in a position to basically get our fleet renewed in a market like that.
Fair enough. And well, round this one out.
Just a couple of points I'd add to what Aristides said in terms of the order book, 14% something on Kamsarmax, over 20 years old, 16%. Ultramax order book, something like 10%, 11%. Over 20 years old, 15%. Capes' order book's around 10%. The over 20 years old is sort of 8%. So it's not just the order book, it's the number of ships that are, you know, not the average age. Even it's the ships that are over 20 years old. And as Matt said, you know, what's going to trigger those ships to go? We've got a lot of, you know, mid-sized ships trading Russian coal. Will they come back into the mainstream market if you know, the Russian situation gets normalized? These are difficult questions to answer, but just the number of those older ships you are seeing, even in places like Indonesia, that shippers are getting stricter on overage tonnage. It's a general trend that, you know, we've seen in a lot in the tanker market, and standards are getting higher in certain trades. And so there's these older ships are going to be chasing more, you know, fewer and fewer trading opportunities. So for the sort of modern, more efficient tonnage, and we haven't even gone into the difference in efficiency between the, you know, a modern, you know, 0 to 5, 0 to 10 year old ship versus the over 20 year old ships. There's a huge discrepancy. So I think that does give us a lot of longer term confidence. But you know, I think a demand shock, as Aristides said, you know, is you know, always on the cards, and that will have a short term, potentially, you know, big impact on the market. We've seen it before, but there's a lot of ships that can naturally, you know, leave the market and rebalance things pretty quickly. So it leads to quite a positive long term fundamental picture for sure.
Got it. Great. William, if I can stay with you, China is always obviously a major driver. You touched on coal a bit, but taking a step back as we look at China as a major player in the dry bulk space, if GDP slowed considerably, how do you think that affects the sector?
I mean, China's economy is not great for sure at the moment. And a lot of that is related to directly and indirectly the appalling state of the Chinese property market. And that, you know, is fundamental to the weakness that we see in China. If we look at the Chinese economy in the areas related to dry bulk, by which I predominantly referring to power, the steel and aluminium production, and grains for food and agriculture, then things are actually pretty steady and consumption growth is actually fairly steady. Bauxite, we've seen huge growth. Electric cars, we know all about. There's a lot of aluminium going into that. A lot of aluminium being used now in high power transmission cables in China. That's a big trend away from copper, which is too expensive. And there's a lot more aluminium that's being used in power transmission. Steel, we've seen a lot of steel exports. I mean, they were very front loaded ahead of the potential tariffs, but as a result, the current numbers we're seeing are not as good as and healthy as they were. But actually, the potential for steel exports is still very strong given the price advantage the steel manufacturers have. So the property market is definitely casting a long shadow over the Chinese economy, but the fundamentals in relation to dry bulk are actually pretty steady, and we're quietly fairly happy with what we see from that perspective.
Great, thank you, Will. Hamish, you have anything to add?
No disagreements with anybody. We basically see the iron ore market being supported by Chinese steel exports. And the power generation market is indeed probably negatively affected by the Chinese property market, but it also seems like it's going to be supported by the need for powering artificial intelligence data centers, which is a big issue in China as it is in the US. It's just China has a much easier time building power plants. So that is likely to support the coal market a little more than it otherwise would be.
Great. Aristides, if I could have you weigh in on this.
Yes, I don't have really something to add except that China has surprised me for the last 25 years in that they come up with a prediction about their growth for the next 5 years and they get it right. So now they are predicting around 5%, if I remember well, growth. I'm sure I feel quite confident that they will be able to continue. And 5% is not negligible. Of course, the balance changes from manufacturing and exporting to services and stuff like that. But they seem to manage to control this controlled economy to have in quite a good fashion. So I'm confident that we shouldn't see terrible issues within China. They are able to handle them.
Okay, Mads, I know your fleet is primarily Atlantic trade, but is there any insight you have on China?
No, you are right about that. We don't have a lot of sort of direct exposure to what happened to China, but it's it's the biggest importer of raw material in the world. So of course we are all indirectly impacted by it, and it's a much more nuanced discussion as both as everyone just alluded to that old way of looking at it and just directly correlating demand with what was happening in real estate doesn't really work anymore. And the Chinese have created sort of their own demand a little bit, right? Especially on the steel exports that is used to many of the infrastructure projects that they're developing all over the world. So that impact we all maybe were fearing at some point from a real estate sector that was really struggling, we just haven't seen it. And it actually is benefiting shipping because you get to carry the same commodities twice. First in the form of raw iron ore and then in the form of steel. And steel is a lot of it is long haul business. It's typically happening in the sub Cape segment, especially the Ultramaxes and below. So I don't know. It's fun to talk about China, but it really is even more predictable than anything. But I wouldn't I wouldn't caution like huge or expect huge disruptions there. We feel like the rest of the panel that it's probably not as bad as you might see on when you look at it.
Okay, fair enough. We're getting close to 40 minutes. I was going to take a before going on. I was going to take a couple of questions from the field here. I'll throw it out there. Regarding yard capacity, do you think the global order book will hold and be delivered on time, or can you expect delays from the yards?
I
I'll
mean,
throw it out to William.
most
Go
of the
ahead,
vessels
Hamish.
being delivered are being delivered on time. There's a few new shipyards really big shipyards that are, have emerged. We talk about consolidation, which we talked about earlier. There's been huge consolidation in Chinese shipbuilding and shipbuilding generally. I mean, of course, there's been a massive shrinkage in capacity from Japan. Korea has consolidated and basically specialized in a few preferred product choices. And in China, we've had consolidation of groups picking up different, individual yards and adding them into larger groups, and some really big, electric car manufacturers and oil refineries have actually expanded their, overall business and their group into shipbuilding and have picked up facilities. And generally, the standards are getting higher. The technology that's being deployed is greater. There's obviously a concern longer term around the workforce, but there's more automation coming in, and we don't see major delays. It's very different to the huge growth in Chinese shipbuilding that Aris talked about, 20 years ago. This is a completely different scene, and it's very high tech, and some of the most sophisticated shipyards in the world are now in China. And there is not huge growth. Oh, sorry, there's not huge slippage in deliveries. We just don't see that.
Yeah,
Fair enough.
I can second that. Our new building orders, really resales, are on time as far as we can tell, and being very well constructed. And China, as William alluded to, has an aging workforce, but it's not like the Japanese workforce, which is, I think, almost my age on average, and the Korean workforce, which is, only just behind.
Okay. Aristides, I'm going to jump to you on this one. With the USTR on Chinese ships going to come up again in next year, international companies will be cautious on Chinese leasing. How do you think this is impacting lending capacity, and has it affect other lenders?
Well, theoretically, it should come up again because they have said that it's paused for a year. So expect a further negotiation between China and the US in a year's time, which may lead to maybe a week or so of disruption, but eventually there will be an agreement again, I think. But of course, anything can happen. With that in mind, I can judge from the way I personally felt. I'm a little bit more cautious about Chinese leasing, just because we can get similar terms with conventional banks. We're not going for huge percentage financing. We're going for good financial terms on the financing. And I think that we can get that from European banks, certainly Greek banks that are very supportive to the owners that they know and they understand. So we're a bit more cautious on that front, and maybe that is what is leading some of the Chinese leasing houses to be overly aggressive these days. They are coming with some offers which, maybe tempt us at the end.
Sure. We have another question. I'll throw it to Mads. Is there any product in the dry bulk commodity area that's of concern to you in terms of softening demand?
No, I don't. I mean, coal, as a couple of the other panelists have talked about earlier, that is sort of that's a new swing commodity, right? It used to be grain, but that sort of the seasonality of the grain market have evened out over the years. So I wouldn't say coal is a concern. I just see that it is a commodity that, for the reason that William explained earlier, are difficult to predict, and subject to other sort of drivers, demand drivers than for instance agricultural products. So it used to be a very stable commodity, very predictable trade flows, but that has certainly changed. I wouldn't say it's a concern, though. I think it's a driver of volatility, which I think all of us on this call, it's part of how we make our money.
Liam, if I may add,
sure, go ahead,
may
Russ,
add something
please.
here. I think this year I was looking at the Clarkson's analysis, and this year It's two cargoes that did worse than the than which didn't grow. Sorry, it was coal trade, which is 4-5% below the previous year, and it's sugar, which is a very small commodity, and I really don't know the dynamics there, and they don't matter. But on coal, I've been hearing for the last 10 years that we have reached peak coal, and perhaps it was 2024 because this year we saw, as I said, about 4% less coal demand. The predictions are for roughly the same next year, and with the need of energy that we have, as Hamish said, for data centers and electrical vehicles and all that stuff, I will be surprised if we see coal reduced in the next couple of years. I think that will not be it will not be a cargo that has less growth. So I agree with Mads that probably it's not really an issue.
Great. And then I can finish up with Hamish on the bauxite trade. It's done, it kept Cape rates going because of the growth there. The question is, do you see that continuing with the potential decline in Chinese aluminum production volumes?
Well, I think if for some reason the bauxite doesn't go to China, which I think it will continue to go to China, but the demand for aluminum is worldwide, and I don't see a situation where aluminum production generally drops. And the bauxite coming from West Africa is some of the easiest, least expensive and easiest to transport bauxite in the world. If the Chinese don't use it, other people will. So I'm not worried about bauxite as a cargo.
Great. We are over the time, but I do want to just hold another minute or so and talk to each panelist about anything that we've covered or any additional thoughts you have on the discussion. I'll begin with William and then we can go through the panel.
Just what as a wrap up, we didn't talk about it too much, but I think the difference in the efficiency between the old and the new tonnage, the modern tonnage that's being delivered, is going to drive those older ships out. The IMO didn't have come up with the net zero framework, but there will be a drive towards efficiency. I think that's for sure. I think in terms of cargo and demand, generally, it's a demand shock that I think is going to provide the surprise within the market. The supply side and the general age of the fleet, inefficiency of the older ships, and the order book as it stands doesn't hold any great surprise, and it doesn't hold any great fear for any shipping investor. And so, I think we look out for the geopolitical shocks that we've had plenty of this year, but actually, generally, as Aris said, it provided some, turbulence for a week or so, and then it all got sorted out. And that's what, we hope for, but you just never know.
Aristides. Thank you, William.
Well, I want to thank my fellow panelists, really. I think we covered a lot of space today, and I found it very interesting to hear the opinions of the fellow panelists and to see that, we think very much alike. That's not that bad,
Mads.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, and there's quality companies on this call, and we each sort of represent different ways of operating in the same market, right? I think we think about our place in the shipping market as we're always very conscious about the fact that we are part of our customer supply chain. Our business model is simple, right? It's how we integrate into our customer supply models that really moves the needle, right? So that's why I think with both the outlook for the shipping markets and potentially a more sort of fragmented trade in the future, and that in combination with our sort of onshore logistics offering as well, we're very excited about the possibilities we see.
Great. Thank you, Mads. And Hamish, if you could bring it home, we'd appreciate it.
Sure. I think probably the most important thing about dry bulk is that the fleet was largely built between ships delivered 2007-8 and 2012-ish, when the order book was 70 to 100% of the fleet in the water. And these ships are mostly very, or many of them, very high fuel consuming ships. And it's a group of ships that's all, very similar in age, that's moving through the pipeline, and they're going to reach scrapping age in a very short period of time. And the shipyards won't have the capacity to renew that block of ships that's going to be scrapped all in a span of a very few years. So, while the fleet is certainly not in shortage right now, it may well be in a few years that there is no way to build enough ships for the world demand.
Great. Well, I think that we have run over our time limit, but I cannot thank everybody enough. This has been a terrific discussion. I always selfishly get a lot out of these, and thank you very much.
Thank you,
Thank you,
Liam.
guys.
Thank
Goodbye.
you.
Thank you.
Hey, gents, all the best. Bye-bye.